This is VOA News. I'm Richard Green. U.S. Senator J.D. Vance of Ohio formally introduced himself to the American voters Wednesday night as the running mate of Donald Trump at the Republican National Convention. Vance used his speech to share his story of his impoverished upbringing in the nation's Appalachian region of Kentucky and Ohio, making the case that his party best understands the challenges facing struggling Americans. Vance is a relative political unknown who has evolved in recent years from a severe critic to an aggressive defender of former President Trump. The 39-year-old Vance is the first millennial to join a major party ticket. He joins the race, has questions about the ages of 71-year-old Trump and 81-year-old President Joe Biden have been high on the list of voters' concerns. Calls for Biden to step aside as the Democratic candidate in this year's election continue to grow from within his own party, Reuters correspondent Zachary Gelman reports.
On Wednesday, U.S. Representative Adam Schiff of California became the 20th congressional Democrat to suggest Biden end his reelection bid against Republican challenger Donald Trump. That's according to the Los Angeles Times, which quoted Schiff saying, "A second Trump presidency will undermine the very foundation of our democracy, and I have serious concerns about whether the president can defeat Donald Trump in November." Democratic concern about the 81-year-old incumbent's ability to beat Trump surged after Biden's halting debate performance on June 27th. But Biden has so far stood firm.
That was Reuters correspondent Zachary Gelman. Meanwhile, the White House says Biden tested positive on Wednesday for COVID-19 while traveling in Las Vegas, Nevada. A spokesperson said the president was experiencing mild symptoms from the infection. Biden returned to his home in the northeastern state of Delaware Wednesday evening. The White House says the president will self-isolate and will continue to carry out all of his duties fully during that time. For more on this and all the stories we're covering, visit us at voanews.com. Israeli authorities on Wednesday released more than a dozen detained Palestinians, some of whom showed signs of torture. AP correspondent Charles Deledesma reports.
The Palestinian Red Crescent Society says that the Israeli authorities have released 13 Palestinians who've been detained for several weeks, picking them up from a checkpoint in the Gaza Strip and onto the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir al-Balah. The group included a woman and a man with vision problems. Zakaria Abu al-Aish said he was detained 55 days ago in the Jabalia refugee camp in North Gaza. "I was handcuffed, blindfolded, deprived from sleeping, no rest. Even the food they brought us was for animals. If you eat or not, no one cares. They dealt with us as if we weren't humans, but numbers." One released prisoner shows the AP marks of torture on his body. I'm Charles Villanesma.
Vice Admiral Brad Cooper, the deputy commander of U.S. Central Command, told reporters Wednesday that the U.S. military-built pier to carry humanitarian aid into Gaza will be dismantled and brought home.
"The pier has done exactly what we intended it to do and what the people of Gaza needed it to do, surge a very high volume of aid quickly."
The dismantling of the pier ends a mission that has been fraught with repeated weather and security problems that limited how much food and other supplies could get to starving Palestinians. As the U.S. military steps away from the sea route for humanitarian aid, questions swirl around Israel's new plan to use the port at Ashdod as a substitute. There are few details on how it will work and lingering concerns about whether aid groups will have enough viable land crossings to get assistance into the territory. But Cooper said the Ashdod corridor will be more sustainable. The U.S. Air Force announced Wednesday that Jack DeShera, a member of the Air National Guard in the state of Massachusetts, will face a military court-martial months after he pleaded guilty to federal charges for leaking highly classified military documents. Here's AP correspondent Ed Donahue.
Texera pleaded guilty in federal court to illegally collecting some of the nation's most sensitive secrets and sharing them on the social media platform Discord. He's facing military charges of disobeying orders and obstructing justice. No date has been set, but the trial will be held at Hanscom Air Force Base outside Boston. At a hearing in May, prosecutors said obeying orders is the absolute core of the military. Court-martial is appropriate. Texera's lawyers argued court-martial would amount to prosecuting him twice for the same offense. The leak exposed to the world unvarnished secret assessments of Russia's war in Ukraine, including troop movements in Ukraine. Texera also admitted to posting information about plans by an adversary to harm U.S. forces serving overseas. I'm Ed Donahue.
For more on this and all the stories we're covering, visit us at voanews.com. I'm Richard Green for VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, July 18th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Republican Vice Presidential nominee Senator J.D. Vance addresses the party's convention. The media worked to combat disinformation on the Trump shooting. The Eswatini government defends a 43-year jail sentence for two members of parliament. Opponents and critics say Rwanda's elections were neither free nor fair.
Rwanda is the paradox of Africa. The Rwandese themselves are afraid to talk about their own election. If you have a vote where 98% of the population vote for one candidate, that is a red flag. Nobody is that popular in this world.
And a new study says women in East Africa are marginalized when it comes to roles in the media. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Republican Party Vice Presidential nominee Senator J.D. Vance of Ohio delivered his acceptance speech Wednesday night at the party's convention in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He spoke about his upbringing from poverty to senator and now vice presidential nominee. Republican Party Vice Presidential nominee Senator J.D. Vance of Ohio delivered his acceptance speech Wednesday night at the party's convention in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Later on in the program, we'll be joined by Kweku Nuama, the professor at the School of International Service at American University in Washington, D.C. The White House said in a statement that Joe Biden has tested positive for COVID-19. The announcement came shortly after he abruptly canceled a Las Vegas speech where he planned to appeal to Latino voters. According to White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre, the 81-year-old president tested positive before his first event in Las Vegas on Wednesday and is experiencing mild symptoms. She added that he is vaccinated and boosted against the virus and will return to his home in Delaware, where he will self-isolate. She said the White House will provide regular updates on the president's status as he continues to carry out the full duties of the office while in isolation. Following the attempted assassination of former President Donald Trump, the media are working to verify details of the attack and to combat fast-spreading misinformation. And ethics experts are looking at how the attack is being framed with Liam Scott, Christina Cassidy. Okay, now we now join our vice presidential nominee, Senator J.D. Vance.
My fellow Americans and my fellow Republicans, my name is J.D. Vance from the great state of Ohio. Tonight, O-H-I-O. You guys, we gotta chill with the Ohio love. We gotta win Michigan too here, so. My friends, tonight is a night of hope. A celebration of what America once was, and with God's grace, what it will soon be again. And it is a reminder of the sacred duty we have to preserve the American experiment, to choose a new path for our children and grandchildren. But as we meet tonight, we cannot forget that this evening could have been so much different. Instead of a day of celebration, this could have been a day of heartache and mourning. For the last 8 years, President Trump has given everything he has to fight for the people of our country. He didn't need politics, but the country needed him. Did it? Now, prior to running for president, he was one of the most successful businessmen in the world. He had everything anyone could ever want in a life. And yet, instead of choosing the easy path, he chose to endure abuse, slander, and persecution And he did it because he loves this country. I want all Americans to go and watch the video of a would-be assassin coming a quarter of an inch from taking his life. Consider the lies they told you about Donald Trump, and then look at that photo of him, defiant, fist in the air. When Donald Trump rose to his feet in that Pennsylvania field, all of America stood with him. And what did he call us to do for our country? To fight for America. Even in his most perilous moment, we were on his mind. His instinct was for us, for our country, to call us to something higher, to something greater, to once again be citizens who ask what our country needs of us. Now consider what they said. They said he was a tyrant. They said he must be stopped at all costs. But how did he respond? He called for national unity, for national calm, literally right after an assassin nearly took his life. He remembered the victims of the terrible attack, especially the brave Corey Comparatore, who gave his life to protect his family. God bless him. And then President Trump flew to Milwaukee and got back to work. Now that's the man I've gotten to know personally over the last few years. He is tough, and he is, but he cares about people. He can stand defiant against an assassin one moment and call for national healing the next. He is a beloved father and grandfather, and of course, a once-in-a-generation business leader. He's the man who is feared by America's adversaries, but two nights ago, and I'll share a moment, said goodnight to his two boys, told them he loved them, and made sure to give each of them a kiss on the cheek. And I will say, Don and Eric squirmed the same way my four-year-old does when his daddy tries to give him a kiss on the cheek. Sorry, guys. He is all those things, but tonight we celebrate he is our once and future President of the United States of America. I want to respond to his call for unity myself. We have a big tent in this party on everything from national security to economic policy. But my message to you, my fellow Republicans, is we love this country and we are united to win.
Republican Party Vice Presidential nominee Senator J.D. Vance of Ohio delivering his acceptance speech Wednesday night at the party's convention in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Joining us live from Washington, D.C. is Kweku Nuama, professor at the School of International Service at American University in Washington, D.C. Good morning to you, Professor.
Good morning, James. Thanks for having me.
Well, we thank you very much for joining us. Well, what is your take so far, Professor, about the vice presidential nominee's speech?
Well, it's a well-delivered speech. He touched on all the key aspects of the Republican platform. He tried to humanize Trump, but he's also brought up old grievances and has pushed the notion that America is in decline under Trump, under Joe Biden, and that Trump is going to restore order and lead another era of prosperity going forward.
So I'd like your take. What do you think so far about the convention since Sunday?
So the convention has been very interesting. The Trump people try to moderate the language because the Republican National Commission, there was a lot of debate about what was going to go into the document that they were going to release. And there's a lot of tension within the party. There are people who want to push hard on a number of issues like abortion, issues like immigration, and issues about funding for the Ukraine war. But they don't want to air these differences at such an event. So they've deliberately avoided talking specifics. And then, of course, you saw what happened after the shooting the assassination attempt on Trump and Trump's own promise that he's going to push for unity. That's important because that's how he gets the sympathy vote. If this event is going to help him, he has to come across as somebody who's trying to unite the country rather than somebody who's reverting to the partisan, toxic Trump that most people remember from his time as president. So you've seen tensions there between people who are coming up, bringing up the old grievances, going back to the old themes of Joe Biden as a failure and as a threat to the nation, and people who have tried to push this idea of Trump as a uniter. J.D. Vance himself straddles both of those things. So tonight in his speech, he talked about the unity that Trump promised, but he also went back to the old grievances, even finding a way to blame Joe Biden for George Bush's war in Iraq.
Professor, we thank you so much for joining us. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
That's Professor Kweku Nuama of the School of International Service at American University in Washington, D.C. Following the attempted assassination of former President Donald Trump, the media are working to verify details of the attack and to combat fast-spreading mis- and disinformation, and ethics experts are looking at how the attack is being framed. With Leanne Scott, Christina Calcedo-Smith has the story for VOA News.
It's a photo seen around the world. Taken by veteran AP journalist Ivan Vucci, the image captures the immediate aftermath of the attempted assassination of Trump at a campaign rally. Here's Ivan Vucci.
It's a normal rally. You know, I've done it hundreds of times. And over my left shoulder, I heard several pops. And I knew immediately it was gunfire.
Vucci is one of dozens of photojournalists covering the Butler, Pennsylvania rally Saturday. The shooting left one bystander dead and injured Trump and others. Images from that day are described by some U.S. media outlets as iconic. But ethics experts are watching to see how, in a polarized time, media and others use the coverage of the attack. Submarion Vincent is the director of Santa Clara University Journalism and Media Ethics Center.
The media needs to stay on the facts and tell the whole story the way it is, but it doesn't have to actually exaggerate. It doesn't have to add outrage to its own actual headlines.
Vincent says the portrayal of the moment will play into the political discourse.
The real ethics of it, I feel, comes in interpreting where the picture is, what it stands for in the narrative about American culture, politics, guns, violence.
For photojournalist Vucci, his priority was documenting the events unfolding right in front of him.
I knew that this was a moment in American history that had to be documented. Our job as journalists to do this work.
In the hours after the shooting, social media mentions of Trump skyrocketed, says cyber analyst Peak Metrics. Most posts were sympathetic, but a smaller percentage spread disinformation and conspiracy theories. That includes baseless claims that political parties on either side are responsible. Analysts say this is where media have an important role in sorting fact from fiction. David Kepler is a reporter for the Associated Press.
There's no evidence for either of these conspiracy theories, but they reflect the kind of claims that are spreading in this very polarized emotional climate in the immediate aftermath of the assassination attempt.
Trump was back in public Monday at the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee, where the now-famous photo is appearing on T-shirts. Cristina Quecedo-Smith, VOA News.
From the Voice of America, I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Thursday, July 18th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Paul Kagame's win in Rwanda's presidential election this week was widely expected, although critics say the vote was neither free nor fair. VOA's Nairobi bureau chief Mariama Diallo spoke to analysts regarding Rwanda's political landscape and files this report from Rwanda's capital, Kigali.
Louis Mudge is the Central Africa Director at Human Rights Watch. Mudge, who lived in Rwanda for several years, says elections there are a mere performance and always produce big wins for President Paul Kagame.
Notwithstanding some of the economic progress that President Kagame's made, he's effectively been in power since effectively July 1994. That progress has not been matched in terms of political and civil rights. And that reflects open space for people to have an independent political platform that disagrees with the RPF.
Kagame won over 99% of the vote, according to preliminary results announced on Monday. Earlier this year, like many analysts, Strathmore University lecturer Edgar Githua predicted the 66-year-old Kagame will win big, but had no doubt the size of the victory would be greatly exaggerated.
Rwanda is the paradox of Africa. Paradox of Africa because the Rwandese themselves are afraid to talk about their own election. If you have a vote where 98% of the population vote for one candidate, that is a red flag. Nobody is that popular in this world.
Kagame, who has held various roles since 1994, won by a similar margin in 2017. At a watch party organized by his ruling Rwandan Patriotic Front, he acknowledged that some people found his margin of victory this year suspicious. He says, "This is a strange thing. That's why there are so many who don't understand it, criticize it, but instead it continues to increase. It's the uniqueness of the RPF and the uniqueness of Rwandans," he said. Indeed, Kagame's supporters, including Samuel Kwazera, say they would vote for him forever if they could.
During the genocide of 1994, I was 4 years old. Now it's 30 years until today. And can see the progress, can see democracy going on. I'm proud. I wish myself, as I love him, he can be forever and ever.
Mudge says while there are Rwandans who will continue to vote for Kagame, this was not a free and fair election.
For our point, as an organization that really defends the civil and political rights of people in Rwanda to express themselves, our point is, the context is very different if you want to express yourself differently, if you want to criticize government policy. There's simply no space for them to operate.
Kagame faced two opponents, Democratic Green Party candidate Frank Habineza and independent candidate Philip Mpayimana. Both received less than 1% of the vote. Other candidates, including some of Kagame's most vocal critics, were barred from running for president, including Diane Ruigara. One of the reasons was that she didn't garner the 600 signatures of support needed in her application. Mudge said in Rwanda's political climate, Ruigara had no chance to get the signatures or a place on the ballot.
With Diane Ruigara and with Victoire Ingabire, this is not about this technical aspect of signatures. This is about not allowing compelling, articulate women to run and to take attention and basically challenging the narrative.
Victoire Ingabire Umuhoza, another critic of President Kagame, who was a presidential candidate in the 2010 elections, was arrested, tried, and jailed on charges of terrorism and threatening national security. She was released 8 years later through a presidential pardon. She says elections in Rwanda have long been predetermined.
Persistent win of a presidential election, if it goes to 100%, is not a sign for popularity, but of lack of competition. And I don't understand why they refuse to allow the most credible challengers to participate against President Kagame in election in Rwanda, because it is not honoring 2024. That was the case in 2003, in 2010, 2017.
Recently, President Kagame called her a genocidaire and said her life will not end well.
I was surprised that President Kagame talking that I am from genocidaire family. But those are accusations using by the government to intimidate everyone who challenges the Rwanda government.
Analysts acknowledge that Kagame does enjoy real popularity among Rwanda's electorate, mainly for his ability to guide the East African country toward internal stability and economic progress since the 1994 genocide, when an estimated 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus were killed by Hutu extremists. At the same time, they say, Kagame continues to stifle dissent as support for the president and his policies is not unanimous. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
A new study says women in East Africa are marginalized when it comes to roles in the media. The Uganda Monitor reports that the study was conducted by the Aga Khan University Graduate School of Media and Communications. It looked at the progress that women have made and gaps in how they are portrayed across the media landscape. Professor Nasi Boker is an associate professor and dean in the Graduate School of Media and Communications at the Aga Khan University.
One of the findings is that we still have very few women in editorial and business leadership in East Africa. Many, you know, journalism schools across the region actually graduate a lot of women students at the end of their 4 year or at the diploma level. But that number doesn't translate to those that then transition into editorial and even in business leadership in media. And that's an important finding, because if you do not have enough women in editorial leadership, where decisions about what makes, then you'd sort of see that then translates into how different stories are covered. So when you have women in positions of editorial leadership, then you have people sitting at the decision-making table. It doesn't mean that, you know, men cannot articulate, you know, women's issues. They can.
You also looked at how women are covered and portrayed in the East Africa media. Tell us a little bit more about this. In which countries are women covered less or more?
This is an interesting finding, that in some of the countries such as Tanzania, you find there's quite some interesting coverage in terms of women being mentioned in headline stories. So you find, or in the top stories of the publication, or several times in the main stories in broadcast. And, you know, one could argue that, you know, because Tanzania has a female president, and most of the bylines of the news story featuring women are written by male journalists, apart from in Tanzania, where you have a good number, you know, close to 70% of the stories that feature women actually, you know, are written by female journalists. In Kenya, that number is about 31%, and in Uganda, it is at about 15%.
So before I let you go, Dr. Boker, what lessons do you think we as journalists can learn from this study?
How we cover and frame women in various media translates into how, you know, women in society portray themselves, or even how they consider themselves. So it's important that we have, you know, women covered, and that even when you're looking at data, for example, that data is disaggregated, and you then look at it from a gender lens. And that can only be possible if you have both men and women sitting at the decision-making table in media organizations, but also in the editorial, because that's where content decisions are made. So what are we doing to ensure that women have the necessary qualifications? How are we supporting them to get the education that then prepares them to aspire to get into some of those leadership positions? It's a collective assignment for all of us, both within newsrooms, but also those of us who lead or head training institutions, that we ensure that, you know, higher or graduate studies, you know, also provide opportunities for women. And if they're limited by virtue of the fact that they cannot afford it, they don't have the resources, then we really have to be intentional about finding ways in which we support them, whether it's through financial assistance or scholarships or whatever it is that we can do, so that as many women in the region can get the education and whatever else they need to be able to succeed.
Professor Nasi Boker is associate professor and dean in the Graduate School of Media and Communications at Aga Khan University. And that is it for this Thursday, July 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm James Bate in Washington.
VOA Africa presents the latest news about Africa and the world and its news summaries. Africa in brief, airs every day at 400, 500 and 600 UTC. Give us 5 minutes of your time to be brought up to date. Africa in brief, your trusted source for News.